Absolute Radio Country is filled with the best sounds from Nashville 24 hours a day. But even we can't fit in everything. You'll find a full story right here. This is Country Music Talk, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the world of country music.
We love bringing you the biggest names from the world of country music here on the podcast, so thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe if you haven't already, and that way you'll never miss an episode. And if you're in the UK, you can listen to Absolute Radio Country live and enjoy the No Repeat Guarantee. It's our promise to never play the same song twice during your workday between 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. Right, on with the podcast.
This is the Country Music Talk Podcast from Absolute Radio Country.
Charlie Crockett, as I live and breathe, here you are with your cloudy apple juice. Welcome back to the UK and welcome to Absolute Radio Country.
Well, thank you, Balin. It's good to be here with you.
You've got a little bit of a love affair with the UK, I reckon. It's been a while. How long have you been coming over?
2017.
Okay.
I think is when I first started coming.
Why did you start coming in 2017? Was there, because, you know, some people come because they've got this big grand plan about ruling international. Some people come because they want to see parts of the world. You've always been, it struck me as a type of guy that likes to see the world. But what was your reason in 2017?
Yeah, I just wanted to see it. And I felt that to be a real artist, you know, American artist from Texas, you needed to build an audience in Europe, you know, like all my heroes. So much of the, you know, best documentary footage I've ever seen is seeing young country boys and folk singers and blues players and American rock and rollers in London, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
And you must have, I mean, I know I've seen it with you, the build of your audience in the UK from the first time that you, because I think we've been talking since the first time that you came over.
Yeah.
I know I've certainly been a fan and been playing you for a while, and we must have met pretty soon after
that. Yeah, man, it was either my first or second tour I ran into you.
Yeah, and I certainly have seen the venues grow, the audiences grow. Let's leave the States to one side for a moment, because that is just absolutely glorious every time I see you there. But here in the UK, people are really digging into it, it seems. Do you feel that when you come back?
Well, the first show you came to, I think there were seven people there, and six of them were me and the band and you.
Yeah, and it's me pooping and hollering.
You know, and a bartender. No, but, you know, it has come a long way. Mm. You know, when I used to first come over here, and, you know, we'd always start in London and work as much of Europe as we could. You know, honestly, I didn't have an agent over here.
Right.
I was being booked by John Folk, you know, on the what we call the Hank Williams circuit over there. And I had, you know, kind of been discovered on a street corner, you know, giving Evan Felker, the Turnpike Troubadours, a CD of the time I was pushing called Stolen Jewel down in Green, Texas. Shortly thereafter that, John Folk, his agent, signed me. And he didn't have an office or anything over here. But I was really all over him to book me here. So he actually hooked me up with a local promoter named Jimmy Walker out of Brighton. Mm-hmm. And kind of pieced together Europe tours. And I remember, and I knew we were doing it grassroots, because those first couple tours, any bar I went to, there wasn't a poster of me anywhere to be found, you know? But that's changed a lot.
Yeah, I always found it interesting when I would go to your early shows, or still now when I go to early shows of artists that are doing it grassrootsy style. Mm. And I look around and think, how do people find the music they're meant to hear? But it always seems to punch through. When the music's good enough, it punches through, whether you're doing it indie style or whether there's a poster of you in the venue or your name's on the marquee. People find good stuff that they connect to, I think.
I think that happens, I don't want to say easier here, but I think it's more like that over here than it is in the States overall, like the word of mouth.
Yeah.
You know, and the interest in roots music or American regional music attached to, like, you know, even if it's something fresh, if it's like attached to traditional.
Yeah.
I noticed the first time I played Glasgow, there were 50 people there, which was a surprise. You know, I mean, we were like stoked. And it was this tiny basement bar that could only hold about 50 people. And so that ended up being one of
those are the best rooms.
Yeah, that was one of our favorite shows. And same thing in Dublin. I'm trying to remember the first couple of places I played here in London, but it was similar there too, where the places were, maybe it could only hold 40 people.
Yeah.
You know?
I was
But there was 40 people there.
It feels so good because the energy in a room like that, you know, I love a low ceiling basement room when everybody's there for the same reason and you're crowded in. It can be far more exciting than, you know, 20,000 people at O2.
You know, honestly, it was, if you know, I say this all the time, you know, it's like if only I could have built it as easily in the United States.
Talking about kind of, you know, you're saying you wish it was as easy in the States. You really put the work in the States. I mean, you put the work in right across it, but also the busking and all of that, which can sound quite romantic, you know, in retrospect. But at the time, was it? Or was it, were you using it as a way to just get better? Were you using it as a way to get from A to B? How was that working for you when you were busking? Because you were busking in Texas and New York and everywhere. You came over here and did a bit of busking, did you?
Yeah, not in England.
Yeah.
But in Copenhagen there in Denmark and down in Paris. And I had a few chances to come do it in London and I never took them back in those days.
Why did you not take them then?
I mean, I was in Paris and had really, you know, fallen. And Paris was tough. Don't get me wrong. The language barrier was more difficult than I had expected. But like compared to London or New York, what's kind of beautiful about Paris, if you're living as a street person, is it's softer. Mm. It's slower pace.
Right.
You know, it does move. You know, it's more lackadaisical.
Yeah.
And that
makes sense.
That benefited me. You know, like, I jump the turnstile to get on the, you know, subways in the metro there in Paris the whole year I was there and never got caught once. The first time I ever hopped a turnstile in New York, I got a ticket.
Oh, every time, yeah.
And it's really hard here, too.
It is.
Y'all
really
are all
hard.
Over. You got more cameras than any place on earth, you know, or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. And I'd always heard that it never stopped raining here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so at the time, I guess I just... I'm sure it actually would have been easier in a lot of ways because everybody's speaking English, but I saw it the other way around. You know, man, there is something. I look back on those days and they feel romantic to me. Of course, it wasn't always all roses in any way, and I didn't start doing it out of some romantic idea. I mean, it most definitely is a career of last resort for me, where packing my grip and a, you know, guitar in a case was, I thought, the safest thing for me to do based on what was happening in my life at the time in Texas. You know, like it looked like the best option for me was to walk out of town, riding my thumb, relying on the kindness of strangers in exchange for these songs and the guitar, just based on all the trouble that I was in, you know?
What kind of trouble?
Big trouble.
Right.
You know, the kind you can read about.
Okay. The kind you write songs about?
Yeah, it's all in the songs for sure. What can I say, man? You know, my mama was, she was a single mama, worked two or three jobs my whole life. I'm from South Texas. She moved up to the big city of Dallas looking for economic opportunity. My daddy wasn't around. My brother and sister had different daddies they were living with.
Right.
We were very isolated from most anybody I was related to. I did get to spend my summers with my uncle living in the French Quarter. New Orleans from around like 8 to 15, 14.
Was that like a magical place to go at that time?
It was.
For me, at that age?
For me, it was, yeah, for me, it was a big escape, you know. And if my mama knew how my uncle was living, she'd have never let me go down there.
Don't tell
mama.
He
was a gambler, big gambler, right. You know, card dealer, you know, ran cards at bingo halls.
Yeah.
Worked as a bouncer at, you know, strip clubs on Bourbon Street, all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. But for me and my cousin Carly, that was her daddy.
Right.
Hanging out in casinos with him all night was just blissful.
Oh, I can imagine.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, aside from kind of escaping the situation that you were in, it just being a kid and being anywhere that isn't your home is already magical. But then there's something about New Orleans that it is like another world.
Mm-hmm.
It is like a whole, you know, it's the type of, it's one of the cities that people dream about going
to.
So I can imagine.
It was one of the best things that happened to me, you know, and I kept it tucked away in my pocket, the memory of being there as a kid. And so I guess it was inevitable that as a street person, kind of all roads lead to New Orleans.
Yeah.
You start hopping trains and you start hitchhiking, playing music, you know, it really all does lead to New Orleans in terms of making money, in front of tourists, learning how to play traditional music of any kind.
Yeah.
Whether it's rooted in the blues, jazz, you know, folk, country, big brass, Dixieland, whatever you want to call it.
I love some Dixieland.
It's all there. Mm. It's all there. And that's where I really learned to play.
And, you know, if you have to have a funeral, have it in New Orleans, because they do it like nobody else.
You're right.
What a way to go.
That's a good death.
It's a good death. If you've never seen a New Orleans funeral, look it up, because it is, I mean, it's fair to say it's a joy.
It's beautiful. That's what it should be. It's a celebration of the life. They're dancing going down the street in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're really sad, but in other times they're really dancing. You know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
St. James Infirmary. You know that song?
Yes.
I learned that song down there, boy. I used to play it 20 times a day, you know, and that's a really, really old song that they trace back to over here even.
Mm.
I think it was called Bartender's Blues is what it's based off of. And it had like 12 verses, and they trace it back to like, I think London or England, Scotland, way back into the 1600s. By the time Louis Armstrong got a hold of it, when he was really changing the idea of, you know, jazz music as pop music in the 30s out of Louisiana, he simplified it down to 3 verses, you know, and it was one of the most, you know, successful songs to come out of New Orleans of all time, you know, and it took this really dark song and made it into like kind of a dancing funeral procession. You know?
It's so interesting talking about that because, you know, I think that this evolution of music, and you're talking about, you know, that coming from here and also just taking a dark song and changing it into something else, and this kind of everything that is kind of what's happening with country music at the moment. And it's also, in some ways, the way people are talking about country music at the moment. I mean, one of the things I've always talked about is the roots of country music coming from this part of the world and going over there and becoming something else. But I mean, now we could even take it to like the Beyonce conversation that people are having. And actually, I was just saying to somebody, that's actually such a deep dive. It's almost a history lesson, the references that she has on that album, but where she's taken something and reclaimed it or taken the nub of something and made it into something else. And you, as an artist in what you do, I've always really loved the kind of traditional underpinning that you have to your songs. But also, I love how it's quite hard to put Charlie Crockett into a box when it comes to country music, Americana music, roots music. You know, there's all these different genres that people like to hang on your belt, Luke. Mm-hmm. But it's always felt to me like you're just doing Charlie Crockett.
Well, I appreciate that, Baylen. That's good. That's a high compliment. You know, all these kinds of music that we're talking about here that we're listing, you know, they're all, to me, just about a beat apart.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to label you. They're going to classify you based on how you look, based on how you sound, where you're from, you know? Do you look like you came from money? Do you look like you didn't have it? Mm-hmm. These are all these things that people use to judge. And you can also look at it as people just trying to understand.
Or connect.
And, you know, and a lot of times, you know, the anger that you see in people judging you just comes from people being maybe afraid or having a hard time trying to understand you.
Yeah.
It's just, but like you said, I mean, ultimately people do just want to connect. What I always appreciate, whether it's George Jones or Jimi Hendrix or Beyonce or any of these artists, what I always have appreciated is somebody who takes tradition and brings it to the front and does something new with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Makes it their own.
Yeah. James Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Zach Bryan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whoever you want to talk about, you know, it's like, I mean, it's the same thing even with the Beyonce record. This is somebody reaching back into a lot of much older forms of even looking at, say, rhythm and blues versus country and doing something new with it. Mm-hmm. Whatever you think about it, that's what she's doing, you know?
Yeah, and it's got people talking.
Yeah.
That's for sure. And
you know what's worse than being talked about?
Tell me.
Not being talked about.
Exactly.
That was one of y'all's boys that said that. Oscar Wilde.
Oh, it was Oscar Wilde with his Green Carnation. $10 Cowboy is the new album from our guest today, Charlie Crockett. You wrote this while you were on tour. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about being a a journeyman or enjoying the kind of the journey, you know, whether it was you busking around the States and into Europe, using kind of the journey, A, to get where you want to be, both physically and I guess kind of metaphysically as well, using your time to create something new. Some people just play PlayStation on their tour bus for 2 months, which is valid, by the way.
Sure.
No judgments there.
Yeah.
But you were inspired by touring to write and by the travel to do this, or were you just making the most of your time?
I mean, Balen, I'm always on tour.
Yes, I know.
I'm just saying, I never stopped touring. I can't afford to say no.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no choice but to write them on the road, you know, and I hear a lot of folks struggle to write on the road and do a lot better writing when they have time, you know, to themselves and kind of hidden away someplace that they like.
Yeah.
And I do well there too. It just doesn't happen much, you know. So if I'm going to write and get a record done, I've got to do it while I'm touring.
Right.
You know, so.
Where are you living now? Are you living in Nashville or are you in Texas?
Near Austin.
Austin is like a.
I'll never live in Nashville.
Never?
Never.
Do you even like visiting?
I like Nashville, the great town if you've never been anywhere. No, I'm just kidding. I do like Nashville. I'm a Texan.
Yeah.
It's a thing, you know, there. It is a thing. In Nashville, it's part of Appalachia, basically. And so it favors very much, you know.
I've never thought about it like
artists that. Artists from that area because that's their region, you know, which is only natural.
Yeah.
There's also a whole lot of New England in there now, a lot of New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. When I was playing on the street in New York City, playing all the folk clubs and open mics, playing the subway cars and all that kind of stuff, I remember seeing a mass exodus of the kind of New York folk scene down to Nashville. And this must have been 08, 09.
Right.
You know? And that continues, including a lot of Texans. Tons of Texans have moved there. And historically in country music, a Texan had to go to Nashville to make it,
yeah,
or to be able to like play the game. I don't think that's necessary anymore.
Yeah, no.
Though I do a lot of business out of there.
Sure.
You know? I mean, I'm grateful for Nashville because, you know, if not for, you know, the Renaissance there, you know, I might still be on the street.
Yeah. Now, you busked in Nashville as well, though, didn't you? Back
I
in
did.
The day, like not too far from the Ryman.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll tell you, man. The first time I tried to play on Broadway, I realized really quickly, because I'd already been playing in New Orleans, I was like, God damn, this is harder than Bourbon Street.
Yeah.
You know, and so in New Orleans, of course, unless you really have a special kind of gimmick, visual gimmick, you avoid Bourbon Street as a street player. The move in New Orleans is to play on Royal Street or maybe down on Frenchman or find a good pocket on Decatur or around Jackson Square or something like that. But what you would need to do in Nashville is play like half a block or a full block up or down off of Broadway. And it's slower there, but they can hear you.
Yeah.
You know, and you could get the attention. And
yeah, because it's a lot to deal with.
What's
Broadway.
Surprising is that if you know, it's most people not knowing, you know, would never suspect that lower Broadway was louder than Bourbon Street. You know, so I mean, that tells you a lot about Nashville right there.
It does, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a lot to deal with just walking down the street,
man,
let alone trying to get somebody's attention by singing a song.
I think they might be drunker on Lower Broadway, on Honky Tonk Row, than they are on Bourbon Street.
I mean, that absolutely rings true to me, although the only place I've ever had alcohol poisoning was New Orleans. So, but yeah, I learned my lesson and that is all fine. I've been playing Solitary Road a lot. I love that song.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Everybody's got to walk that lonesome valley. And at times, they got to walk it all by themselves.
$10 Cowboy is the brand new album from our guest, Charlie Crockett. So the Opry is a real bucket list for a lot of artists. What was it like for you when you made your Opry debut? Because obviously I know it's a bucket list thing. I know the importance of the circle and all of that. But also I know you're a Texas boy, you know, and the Opry, while meaning a lot of the same things, does it still have the same kind of draw for you that it does maybe for an artist that grew up in Tennessee with the Opry shadow over their shoulder?
It meant more to be invited to Willie's 4th of July picnic. But honestly, you know, I'm a really big fan of Hank Williams Sr. And though he's, you know, been immortalized now, in his heyday, he really was very disruptive mm-hmm. to Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
And to know that he stood there, you know, they've got, you know, I've done it three times. Okay. What I still haven't done, which would be what it would really feel like, the closest thing you could do to what the Opry really was back in the heyday would be to do a Opry broadcast from the Ryman, which they still do occasionally.
Yeah.
But all three of mine have been out at the Gaylord Opry, which is totally different. You know, it's a kind of building that was, I don't know what built, maybe in the 80s.
I was thinking late 70s, early
80s. Like that.
And people still call it the new Opry, which I think is quite fun.
Yeah. Well, because that, you know.
Yeah.
It ain't the old one. And, I was still mystified by it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then the pressure of having to play with the house band and being so nervous I couldn't think straight.
Yeah.
That washed over me, you know, because it does all add up. Even if it's encased in plastic and house plants and whatever you want to call it, it still means a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and then the last time I played it, which was just not too far back, I finally got to play with my band. That meant a lot because most of those guys, only maybe one of them had been on stage with me there. And so the rest of my guys in the Blue Drifters, it was their first time to ever play on the Opry. And they were like schoolboys about it.
Yeah.
You know?
It has that effect.
So, I mean, it still gets me every time, you know? But it reminds me of Waylon Jennings' song, Bob Wills Is Still the King. Everybody knows that, you know, Nashville's the home of country music. On that, we can all agree.
Mm-hmm.
When you cross that old river, Hoss, it just don't mean a thing.
Charlie Crockett is our guest today. Just before I let you go, Charlie, I was just thinking, you know, I always love speaking to you, and I love watching you perform, but you are a man of such few words when you are on stage. You really do let the music do the talking on stage, right? Is that a choice? Did you used to gab a lot in between songs? Is that a busking holdover?
Yeah. You know, playing on the street was interesting because it's always interesting with all the English musicians that I've met, like how fascinated they are by the South, American South.
Yeah.
You know, especially like Texas and Louisiana. Mm. When I was playing on the street initially, all I was doing was playing in public to kind of get away with putting music first in my life.
Right.
There was no system set up for me to pursue music. You know, I had to fall out of the good graces of society to find it. And playing in public was how I was getting away with teaching myself how to play in front of people. But they weren't really paying me in the first couple of years. The money I was getting was purely out of sympathy, you know, or here's 10 bucks, stop playing, you know. When I used to play in front of Cafe Du Monde, you know, right there on St. Peter's at the crosswalk, like just across the little fence that fences in, you know, the tables there where everybody's getting beignets and Café au lait.
Yes.
And when I was first doing that, we were having a really hard time. And the tourists were heckling me, because they are drunk, and just really being hard on me. I remember the moment that there were these older guys that were just really giving it to me. And I'd been gotten like that by New Orleans tourists over and over that were just heckling me right out of the place. And I remember the night that I turned around and just started giving it back to them and surprised the hell out of these old boys. And I'll never forget the guy's face. He looked at me and then he pulled out money and he dropped it in my case. You know, once I started giving it back to them and like lost the fear, you know?
Yeah.
Man, they started paying me. And that's what I mean when I say learning to stand behind my guitar. It's about that. It was about getting the songs. You had to get those songs. And in New Orleans, you needed to know traditional songs.
Mm.
Otherwise, you were just another two-bit hustler. You needed to have traditional, whether it was drinking songs or New Orleans jazz or, you know, Carter family folk stuff. You needed the real stuff. And you got that off of all the other street players. You didn't get it from the tourists. You didn't get it from the high society folks. You got it from all the other street players. Even right now, if you and me went down there right now, we could find it in the street players, the real stuff. So it's like I had to get a hold of that, which took years. And then it also took years to realize that, like, they want you to tell them what to do,
mm-hmm.
especially those tourists, you know? That's where I learned to get the banter. But then when I started touring really heavily around the United States, it's like you said, most of the people that I was dealing with were relying on trying to talk to the audience between songs. But what I noticed, you know, when I was watching like Waylon and Willie, as I was starting to study them, they're chaining all their songs together.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not jamming out for 7 or 8 minutes. They're playing tight songs and like no banter in between. Don't give them any time to question you. Don't give them any time to get bored with you, you know, if you've got it, if the songs are there, if the performance is there, you know. And usually when I try to talk to the audience, you know, for whatever reason, it worked really well on the street. But as a touring musician, I feel like it took away from their experience.
Okay.
For me, you know.
Congratulations, Charlie, on everything that's happened. I'm always so excited when new music comes out. And I mean, you don't keep us waiting long.
I won't make you wait too long this time either.
I'll see you next time, Charlie. Thank you.
That's a deal, Hoss.
The Country Music Talk Podcast from Absolute Radio Country.
An in-depth look behind the scenes at the world of country music.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll have another dropping soon for y'all, so don't forget to keep it country.
If you enjoy the Country Music Talk Podcast, chances are you'll also enjoy Absolute Radio Country. It's the place where real music matters, and we love country music just as much as you do. You'll find us online on the free Absolute Radio app, on digital radio throughout the UK, or just ask your smart speaker to play Absolute Radio Country.